The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
In what ways does Monty Harris behave like a Wolverine?
He is very orderly, but he's ready to tackle anything. And he likes challenges. You know, that Wolverine's going to just climb straight up that peak and conquer lots of territory. And he's going to do the same thing, especially in solving a case. He's just going to keep pursuing new territory until he figures it out.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Christine Carbo about her second crime novel, Mortal Fall. Monty Harris is a Glacier Park police officer, which is a job that you made up. Why did you invent a police force instead of, say, having Monty be part of the county sheriff's office?
This book is standalone, although there is mention to The Wild Inside, which was my first book, that also takes place in Glacier Park. The first book is an entirely different character, but Monty plays a secondary role in that book and helps that character with his investigation in the first one. And so in that first one, I decided to create a park police force, even though in Glacier it's rangers that are trained with law enforcement and we don't have a separate park police. And So I think I just took that creative license, took that liberty to do so because I thought that I might have chances for more conflict, because I think when we're writing, any writing, but especially crime fiction, you know, conflict is the well that you want to go to and drink from. And so I thought the more factions that I had, the more conflict I'd be able to create. And once I had done that in the first book and then plucked a character from that book and put him in the second book, I felt like I needed to stay true to the way I'd set that dynamic up.
Yeah, that was interesting that you didn't have the same main character in the second book.
Yeah, and I struggled with that because a lot of people wanted me to continue with Ted, who's in the first book. However, I felt that his story arc kind of played out. Not that there's not any possibility of me doing something with him in the future, but for now, I felt that his story was played out for the time being.
When the story begins, Monty is called in to investigate the death of a Wolverine researcher, although they don't know that when they first go down, somebody who's fallen off the edge of a steep drop-off and has died. So this happens in Glacier National Park. And this is from the point of view of Monty, and I'd like you to just read a passage from Chapter 2.
Okay. The roar from the helicopter filled my ears and rattled my bones. Small green leaves, dust, and white feathery filament from the cottonwood trees flurried madly as the chopper hovered above like a parent waiting impatiently for Ken and me to complete the long line retrieval. Bright orange ropes with carabiners in a litter, a metal basket used to place the body in, dangled above us. We'd already wrapped the corpse in fabric and placed it in a maroon body bag. I was still in shock after realizing it was Wolfie. If it wouldn't have been for his large frame and his distinct blonde wavy locks that looked like they belonged on an adolescent and not a grown man, I wouldn't have had any recognition. Paul Wolfie Sedgwick was a biologist and one of the lead researchers of the Wolverine research team. He had been nicknamed Wolvie early on, but over the years the V had drifted to an F. It was easier to say Wolfie than Wolvie. Ken and I had been on the scene for over 3 hours, photographing the victim from all angles, inspecting rock crumbled away by the velocity of the body crashing against it, and skid marks from the sliding. I'd taken notes, and we'd tweezed samples from his clothes torn off by some of the more jagged rocks above, at least the one we could climb to. We couldn't get to some of the higher points above. that he'd potentially hit on the way down, presuming we had judged the launch point accurately. Joe had radioed down to us that they found a car in the Loop Trail parking area with a license registered to Paul Sedgwick. His ID was also in the glove box. Ken and I looked for evidence of suicide or foul play, but saw none. No note on him, no suspicious injuries that might have been from something other than the fall, like a ligature mark or a gunshot wound, but the coroner or pathologist would be able to look more closely. I couldn't wrap my head around the idea that a man with so much experience in the backcountry could fall this close to the loop, so near the main, and only pass through the park. His team of Wolverine researchers had skied all over Glacier Park in the dead of winter in sub-zero temperatures and biting wind chill to set the mini log cabin traps used for baiting them. Wolverines were the least known and most elusive animals in the Northwest, and cunning and tenacious enough to run off a grizzly bear over a dead carcass with its long claws, sharp teeth, and badass attitude. Wolfie's team had trekked across large massives, scaled monumental crags, rambled up high summits, and skied across ice over lakes tracking the creatures and looking for their dens, hoping to find clues about their behavior and how strong their population is after decades of being trapped in the Northwest. Ken and I divided the ravine into grids and searched for signs of the animal just in case Wolfie had tried to foolishly climb down to track one. We looked for the telltale triangular-shaped print made from the animal's five toes, which would splay out when its paws compressed into the dirt or mud, its sharp-pointed claws leading the way. We checked for scat, cylindrical pellets with fur, bones, and feathers from its scavenging. We found nothing along those lines other than Wolfie's other hiking boot nestled in some bushes lower down. Had this burly blonde man been so consumed in his research that he'd gotten careless and simply fallen to his death? Or had he been suicidal, drinking or on drugs? I pictured Wolfie, his long, loose locks blowing in the mountain breeze, his wide grin, and his healthy, weathered, and ruddy skin. I couldn't conceive of any of those scenarios, but it was too soon to make assumptions. When the large metal hook from the helicopter finally reached ground, Ken and I moved Wolfie carefully onto the metal litter, hooked up the four lines to the center catch, and signaled for the chopper to lower a bit more. When the hook came into reaching distance, I grabbed it and snapped the catch from the litter onto it and signaled for the pilot to rise. I watched the basket, hanging underneath the chopper like a fly in a spider's filament, swing away. Slowly, they'd take the body to a gravel pit near McDonald Creek, an opening used for construction vehicles where the coroner waited. I glanced up to Heaven's Peak again, then up to Logan's Pass to the panorama surrounding it. The crown of the continent stood massive and indifferent, beautiful and rugged, a place where time loses its significance and history shoots up out of the ground, its presence overwhelming and demanding, making you feel useless and small. The biologist, trying to understand the near-mythical creature known for its toughness and resilience, but threatened by the loss of the glacial snowfields necessary for its winter dens, was now officially done with his research, officially done with his life, his family. The finality of it was every bit as humbling as the peaks towering above us. I thought of Lara, how our once rock-solid bond had slowly but surely crumbled, and I felt a weight fall upon me like a heavy cloak. I undid the strap under my chin and removed my hard hat to get some air. My scalp was sweaty, the tips of my close-cropped hair gathered into wet points and clinging to the back of my neck and around my ears. For some reason, I suppose in homage, I held the helmet over my chest as if I were honoring the flag. I watched the chopper fly down the line of McDonald Creek, its dark strip of water flickering in sunlight and carving through the countryside at the base of Heaven's Peak. I watched it all the way until it grew very small and its roar softened to a faint growl as it went around the bend toward the gravel pit 3 or 4 miles down the road. I put the hard hat back on and let out a groan in the silent contrast. "It's not going to be easy telling Wolfie's wife and kids," I said. "No," Ken agreed, "it's not."
Another thing that's not easy in the story is Monty's relationship to his own wife, Laura. And during the investigation, his thoughts keep going to her and trying to figure out what's going to happen with their relationship. So explain what's going on with him and his wife.
Well, Monty's had a difficult upbringing in his family. He comes from a pretty troubled situation where his father is an alcoholic. His father turns to alcohol. He's kind of desperate. He's been dealing with Monty's mother, who's got some psychological issues. And she's actually got some paranoia, schizophrenia. And his upbringing, his brother's as well, has been tough. And his older brother has made it tougher because his older brother has been a little bit of a bully to Monty. And so Monty, I think, feels, you know, when he met and married his wife, he made it very clear that I don't want children. I mean, I feel that I have this genetic situation in my family where I'm going to be passing some not so pretty traits down with my mother's mental health. And when they first married, she was actually fine with that, and it wasn't a problem. And so they fell in love, they married, and they were kind of plugging along, and as far as he knew, happily. She, on the other hand, was kind of going through some changes, and things don't necessarily stay the same. And she decided that she did want to have children. And I don't want to just narrow it down to the time clock ticking. You know, I don't want it to sound trite, but she kind of did have her time clock ticking away a little bit and decided that she did want to introduce that into their relationship. And so it became a big problem between the two of them because he was very adamant that was something he was very nervous about doing.
Right. And I don't think it was necessarily a biological clock, but she came from a large family and her siblings were having children. And at family gatherings, it sounded like she could see what she was missing out on.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That was a big component for her.
And so Monty is living in a dorm in the park.
Right. Yeah. And in some ways, not entirely unhappy with that because Glacier's kind of his escape and his, in my first book, the main character felt very haunted and very threatened by Glacier. In fact, Glacier almost in itself was like almost an antagonistic character for him. And with Monty, I really like the idea of Glacier being more of a safe haven.
Well, I think you found a great setting for these books, the crime series that takes place in Glacier.
I mean, certainly Nevada Bar has done, you know, all the national parks, including Glacier. And there's some crime fiction novels set in Montana, Gwen Florio. But anyway, I think it's a great setting.
Yeah, I was thinking about the perspective of someone who doesn't live in the West reading about Glacier. I think it would be very different and interesting.
Yeah, I think it's great.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Sheree Newman. Christine Carbo is here, and we're talking about her second crime novel, Mortal Fall. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed and share this conversation with a friend at our blog. We also podcast every program. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find links to our Facebook and Twitter pages there. After a short break, we'll find out more about wolverines, Glacier National Park, and Christine Carbo. Don't go away. Well, part of this story is about the dichotomy of Glacier as this natural, pristine place. So the tourists come through mm-hmm. and they see the beauty and they spend a day or two or a week and they don't realize what's going on behind the scenes, that there are hunters and trappers out there doing things they shouldn't do. So describe a little bit of that, because that was part of this story as well.
Right. And we were talking earlier about the whole law enforcement thing, and that was one thing I didn't bring up, and that's that Monty spent some time as a game warden, so he had a little experience in that realm of law enforcement too. There is illegal poaching and trapping going on. The Wolverine has been a hot topic in terms of whether it can be protected or not. You know, there's the numbers are not high for Wolverines. They are threatened by the loss of the glacial snow fields that are melting rapidly. And so I think that it's an interesting dynamic to explore. A lot of the local people, you know, are conflicted about using animals as a pawn, so to speak, I think a lot of people feel on some level like the grizzly bear has been used as a pawn to stop development or to halt the progression of certain things, and, you know, good, bad, or otherwise, or however you want to argue it. You could see how some locals would feel that could happen with the Wolverine as well. So you could see where a Wolverine biologist might be a little bit, you know, disliked for some of the work they might do.
Mm-hmm. Because the research is going to be quantified and
yes.
put into a document that will be presented to
yes.
authorities maybe in Washington, D.C., and the federal government will then mandate what can happen to land that locals feel
exactly.
like is theirs.
Exactly.
Which has been in the news in various ways in the last few months.
Exactly, yeah. You said that much nicer than I would even right now. So,
how long have you lived in the Glacier area, and when did you get interested in writing about it?
So I moved to Montana, to the Flathead Valley, to Kalispell with my family when I was actually in eighth grade. And I moved from Florida to Montana. And I've been there a long time. I've gone away to various places to go to college and live and work, but eventually came back and went to school at the University of Montana, and then I went back and taught at Flathead Valley Community College for a number of years. And while I was there, I dabbled around with writing a little bit. I actually wrote two non-genre novels while I was there in kind of my late 20s, early 30s, and decided that, I really enjoyed the novel writing process. But around the same time that I was starting to just experiment with it and had these two books under my belt, I went through a divorce and I, you know, had a little boy to raise, and I went into survival mode in terms of grading papers all the time and took on extra work doing technical writing to make some more money. And it's something I could do late at night when my little boy was in bed. And I ended up putting aside creative writing for a very long time, probably for over a decade. And when I came back to it, I decided very deliberately that I was going to write a crime fiction novel. And partly I decided that because I knew there was a big readership for it. And also, I knew that I love to read it. And, you know, I really just enjoy reading it. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to write what I enjoy reading. And so I set about that task of I'm going to write a crime fiction novel. I know nothing about law enforcement. I know nothing about investigations. I don't even know where I'm going to set this because I don't live in New York City or LA with tons of crime, or a mysterious Dublin and Scotland and Glasgow. And like a lot of the novel crime fiction novels I read, they were all taking place in these very cool places. And I was thinking, wow, you know, is anybody really wanting to hear about Kalispell or Whitefish where I live? Or so it's kind of like the light bulb went off that, wait a minute, I have Glacier Park right here in my backyard where millions of visitors come every year. And I personally have spent tons of time hiking miles and miles of glaciers terrain because I have always loved it, you know, ever since I moved here from Florida when I was young and I'd go hiking with my family. And so once that light bulb went off, it was just, you know, glacier was just a magnet for me then in terms of the writing.
I wondered about your decision to make your main characters in both of the books men.
Yeah, when I started with The Wild Inside, it just came to me that way. And the main character's voice came to me in a male voice. And I think, you know, I don't have any sisters. I grew up with two brothers. I don't know exactly why it came to me that way. Maybe because there's predominantly a lot of males in the law enforcement industry. It could be that. I mean, I'm certainly not sexist about it or anything like that. It's just the way it came to me. And so I said about that. And then Monty, like I said, played a secondary role in the first book. And as I continued on writing him, I knew that I wanted to go further with him. So he became a natural progression for the second book. However, I am working right now on a third book, and I do have a female main character. So.
Oh, I wondered if that was going to happen.
Yes.
Yeah, many publishers do contract for three books. So when I got to the end of this one, I wondered if we were going to see Monty and Gretchen again.
Yeah, and so actually Gretchen is my lead character in the next book. And I was not contracted for three books. Honestly, I was contracted for two, but yay, I've been contracted for another two. So there are at least two more coming down the pike at some point, yeah.
You were able to weave some of the climate change issues, some of the animal issues, and the law enforcement issues into the story. I thought you did that very well.
Thank you. I actually feel like that is a pleasure. I feel like it's a privilege for me to be able to talk about the beauty of the place I live and the natural area of it, and expose what's going on without being, I try not to be preachy or didactic about it at all, because that's not my intention. I'm not trying to write an eco-thriller or any of that kind of thing. I just want to write what I discover, research what I know about the area, and I try and be fair, you know, to all sides of the story in the area. But I feel like you know, it's nice to be able to address some of the issues through crime fiction. You know, I'm not being a reporter. I'm just writing a story that I hope entertains people. And if they can get a glimpse of it or have a little empathy for this animal or respect an animal a little bit more or the people that live around it a little bit more, that I think that's a nice thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I learned something about a Wolverine.
Good.
Monty's brother is named Adam, and there's a very complicated relationship there.
Yes, very complicated. Adam and Monty were involved in a situation when Monty's young. Because Adam was such a bully, he did things and he played jokes on him. And I mean, jokes even sounds like a kind word for the kinds of things that Adam did to Monty. I mean, he was quite the bully. But one of the things that happened was that Monty and a friend were involved in a situation where it was just really supposed to be a practical joke on Halloween, but they were left at a cemetery and to have some fun with them and to be mean as well. But, you know, it was Halloween night. And so Adam and a few of his buddies cajoled them kind of out of the car and then drove off and left them there. And they had every intention of coming back and picking them up. But they go off to kind of, they just leave because they figure they've been left. And so they go to leave to walk home. And in the dark, they get split up. And some things happen to one of them. I don't want to reveal too much of the story, but it ends up becoming a haunting thing between Monty and his brother. And Adam ends up going to a therapeutic school because of getting involved in all sorts of crazy stuff after this and feeling even guiltier about you know, and being even more reckless and dealing with a troubled mother. And so Adam ends up at this therapeutic school that ends up coming into the investigation much later within this investigation in this book. And so it really plays, it's an interesting dynamic for Monty to go through.
Yes. In addition to being separated from his wife, he's got this anger between him and his brother. And it sounded like the situation that happened to Monty and his friend Nathan when they were young boys might have had something to do with the reasons that Monty became a park police officer.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think it weighed very heavily on him and continues. And he's going to still be in the third book as well. And he continues to struggle with that. Another interesting element about the book is that Monty, other than helping out with the first investigation in the first book and having a little experience as a game warden, some investigative experience through that, he really is a rookie investigator. And so it's kind of fun to see him go through that process of getting better at the job, whereas I think a lot of crime fiction books, you dive in and you're already, you know, unless you're with a sleuth, you're already with a pretty seasoned investigator. And I thought it was kind of challenging and fun to write somebody who is a little bit of a rookie and is learning as he goes as well.
And having to deal with pressure from especially the park superintendent, who wants this case wrapped up now.
Right.
And he wants it to be ruled an accident. He doesn't want murder happening in the park to
No, and you know, and this and again, these are fictional characters, so in no way, shape, or form am I trying to mimic any real park superintendent, but it's really fun to have a superintendent who kind of does that tight control of information that they want to go out to the public for public relations purposes. So,
Not quite as controlling as he was in the first book, the same superintendent.
Correct. Yeah, yes.
Who actually lied when a bear killed somebody.
Yeah, you know. I toned him down a little bit because that also was a natural progression because Monty actually had a decent relationship with him. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't as, you know, antagonistic as it was with Ted. And so I wanted him to still do that breathing down his neck thing, but I wanted to not have it be out of control and realistic. Because Monty's also, he's somebody who's going to work with people. He's going to get the job done.
He's very professional. It's his personal demons that create a lot of the tension.
Yes.
In this story. Christine Carbo lives in Whitefish, Montana. Look for more information about her and her books, Mortal Fall and The Wild Inside, at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find poems and children's book reviews there, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.